Tonight on Arena, 150 years after his death, the life of Charles Dickens in his own words, and a new short story collection from Richard Ford. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Charles Dickens died 150 years ago in June 1870, and in his 58 years of life, experienced both extreme poverty and serious wealth, themes which were ever present in his great works. In a moment, we'll talk about Dickens with his new biographer, Derwin Hope. But first, let's listen to a clip from the classic film David Copperfield, starring W.C. Fields as Mr. Micawber, a character said to have been modelled on Dickens's own father, John, a spendthrift who spent time in debtor's prison. Here, Micawber has found refuge in his own home through entry from a skylight as the debtors wait at the door.
Pursued, or aerial housetop, and vice versa, I have thwarted the malevolent machinations of our scurrilous enemies. In short, I have arrived.
This is Master David Copperfield, who has come to lunch with us.
Oh, just so. Pardon me, children. All that we have is yours, Master Copperfield. Our domestic comfort, quiet, the privacy. Call and mute only.
Thank you, sir.
Count on us, now and forever.
I will, Mr. Micawber.
Now that you're about to share with us the privileges of our domain, I will make no stranger of you. As man to man, I will confide in you that for years I have been hounded, most unjustly, by my creditors. Short-sighted fools they are.
I'm sorry, sir.
But now?
Yes, Mr. Micawber?
I am confidently expecting something to turn up.
He's confidently expecting something to turn up. W.C. Fields as Mr. Micawber and Freddie Bartholomew there as David Copperfield from the classic film of the Dickens tale. Joining me now on the line is Derwin Hope, author of Charles Dickens' My Life. Derwin, the title of the book says lots to us, in fact. The fact that it is Charles Dickens' My Life suggests an autobiography. But of course, Dickens didn't write an autobiography, did he? So what's going on in the book?
No, very nice to speak to you, Sean. Yes, he didn't, and he wanted to write his own life story, but he died, as you've already said, when he was only 58, and he didn't get round to doing it. And I have, for the first time in 150 years, gone through all the material that I could find that he has produced, including 15,000 of his letters that have now been published, and journalism, speeches that he made, all about his life, and put them together as a continuous narrative. So you've got the nearest thing possible to an autobiography. It's him telling his own story for the first time.
You're not a biographer by trade. You're a QC and a judge, in fact. What spurred you on to take on this huge task to go through all those writings and works and research?
Yes, it is a huge task. Well, I almost fell into it, really. I've always been fascinated by the story of people's lives. And about 20 years or so, I heard that Dickens may have led a secret life. And so I began reading everything I could on him. And then, completely by chance, in 2004, I became a judge in Portsmouth. And that was, of course, his birthplace. And I visited the humble house of his birth and stood in his bedroom where he was born. And the question went through my mind, how did he get from here to the life of fame that he went on to lead? And how much of this did he explain in his own words? And that was what really triggered me off on my research. And that's how I came to start reading everything I could for the next decade about him. And then I retired in 2014 and sat down for nearly 4 years and pieced all this huge jigsaw puzzle together.
Now, I don't want to give away the ending, but did you unearth the secret life? Did you get to what you wanted to get to?
Yes. It's with his... well, she's usually called his mistress, Nellie Tiernan. He was 45 at the time in 1857 in his loveless marriage and desperately unhappy, and he met this girl who was 18, attractive, and possessing an intelligence way above her years, and he describes himself as instantly being seized with lunacy and fell hopelessly in love with her.
Well, we'll come back to what that behaviour, how we should view that behaviour maybe a little bit later on, because obviously it's towards the end of the story that you're telling. That childhood, the first 5 years of his childhood, I think, were relatively okay, according to the writings. It was only after that that things started to go awry. What went wrong?
Yes. Well, basically, his father kept spending money that he didn't have. And he rather grandiosely described his job as a responsible situation under government, but he was in fact only simply a naval pay clerk. And he quite clearly drank quite a lot, and he felt unable to live within his means, and the family sunk deeper and deeper in debt. And basically 2 days after his 12th birthday, Dickens' parents sent him out to work on a pittance in dreadful conditions that he describes in his life story. But it didn't save the family. And 11 days later, his father was arrested for debt. He hadn't paid his wine merchant's bill. And he was locked up with other members of the family in the Marshalsea debtor's prison. And Charles was left to fend for himself. And he describes how it broke his heart. That was really when he had no money at all. You know, when he was about 12, he'd gone right down to the bottom. And I found a letter where he described later being so hungry that he would go into Covent Garden and stare at the pineapples, which probably only served to make his situation worse, in fact.
Yeah, I said the first five. It was between the ages of 5 and 10, things were particularly good for him. He was at a prep school and things were going very well. That's where he had his first experience of reading and books as well. But that work that he took on as a young teenager in Camden Town, to what extent would you say, Derwin, that in fact sowed the seeds for the type of social view that he would express later on, particularly around child labour and particularly around how children were treated in Victorian England?
Oh, yeah, it went right down into his soul. It was actually at where Charing Cross Station is now. Hungerford Stairs was where the factory that he was working in, the blacking factory. It was just an experience that was ingrained on him for the rest of his life, and I'm sure that it was the basis for much of what he later did in all sorts of ways. He desperately didn't want to go to the debtor's prison like his father, and he turned him into a workaholic, and he just worked his way out of it, which was, again, amazing the way he did that.
Yeah, it is extraordinary, actually, when you think that he had that very difficult early teen years. But then, before too long, he's working in law, he's working in journalism, and he's writing to a society that, you know, he could have been excluded from had he not got himself out of that poverty trap.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it was one of the most remarkable turnarounds ever witnessed in any person's life, I think. He, from being this absolute destitute child, his parents sent him to a lawyer's office basically as an errand boy, and he described that place as a stronghold of melancholy, one of the most depressing institutions of bricks and mortar known to the children of men. And he couldn't wait to get out of that. And the way he did that was to learn shorthand writing so that he could escape and better himself, because he wanted to become, at that stage anyway, a parliamentary reporter.
And he did go on to write under the pseudonym Boz in the Morning Chronicle. And
that's
fact where he met his wife as well, isn't it? The boss's daughter.
That's correct. Absolutely right, yeah. Now, and he met the whole family. And in fact, if you read between the lines, he married Catherine, the eldest, but really I think he was in love with Mary, the second one, who tragically died in his arms when she was 17.
Again, only in Dickens's arms could somebody die tragically when they were 17. His life almost is that life is almost like one of his novels.
I know it is the whole. Well, this is what struck me, is that his whole life story is like a novel, and this is why I wrote it in the way I did. Because as I was going along, I did it in stages, and I had a sort of working title at one stage of The Real David Copperfield, because it was like a novel.
How quickly did we get to the successes of The Pickwick Papers, Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby, which are among the early books?
Well, he once he started writing himself, he started with this thing called the Sketches by Boz, which were in newspapers, and they caught on, and he had those published. And then immediately he started writing the Pickwick Papers. Mm. And it was the Pickwick Papers that really took off and made him what he was as a novelist, because that was what rocketed him to fame. He was about late 20s when that happened.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, it's such a huge turnaround. I know lives possibly yeah. were shorter at that time, and middle yeah. age was probably 30, 35, maybe even 20-something was middle age. But, yeah. you know, he wasn't only a star at home, he was a star abroad, and particularly
everywhere.
In America.
Oh, wow, yes. I mean, he eventually went to America. He went to America twice, but his first visit in 1842, he was mobbed. It was like, I didn't realize this until I read it. He was mobbed like we know of the Beatles these days. You know, it was called Bosmania. And he landed in Boston and they tore his coat off him.
Now, they clearly loved him. And he got on very well with his audiences. But when he came home, he was far from generous and far from praising of the American system that he saw.
Yeah, he loved the people loved him. But what happened was he went over there because I think in part at least there was no international copyright. And so what was happening was his books were being sold over there. And he wasn't getting any money. And the publishers and the newspaper people who took his books were pocketing all the money. And he was, not surprisingly, a bit upset about this. And he made a couple of speeches about this, criticizing them. And they turned on him in a major way. And he was absolutely pilloried in the American press, as opposed to the people. So there was a complete divergence about who liked him and who didn't. And he got a terrible press over there at that time. And this is what was fed into the system. And then when he came home, he started writing Martin Chuzzlewit with the American Connection, and they didn't like that, and they didn't like his American notes that he wrote as well about his travels there.
And of course, he did travel to Ireland, although he expressed reservations at one stage about the Fenian unrest, as he put it, that was happening here.
Yeah.
But let me finish up by asking you about Nellie Ternan then, and, you know, how you feel. Remember, you're telling us his life in his words.
Yeah.
How does he express, or how does he think, or what does he think about his own treatment of his wife, Catherine, and the subsequent affair with Nellie Ternan? And in fact, according to you and two of his children, that there was a child who died in infancy between himself and Nellie Ternan.
Yeah.
How does Dickens, does he moralise over that, or does he say, Asher, I was only having a bit of fun? What's his attitude to it?
No. This is another real eye-opener to me when I was reading his letters leading up to all of this and his separation in particular, because going back one little stage, he was incredibly generous to women. He helped women generally, and any widow that found herself without any husband and no money, he was the first to help them. And he just got this terrible depression about his marriage. It was just a loveless marriage in the end, and he didn't know what to do with it. He got terribly depressed. And he wrote some letters to his friend Forster saying, you know, it was as much his fault as anything. It was a terrible thing that had happened, and he wanted to be separate and generous to his wife and everything. And then it all exploded in his face because his mother-in-law and another sister of his wife started accusing him of having an affair with a third sister, Georgie, who lived with him and looked after the children. And this was all dreadful stuff. And he just exploded and said things that perhaps he was better off not saying, and doing things that he shouldn't have done. It all collapsed around him.
Well, I'm sure the debate about how Dickens treated his wife will go on for some time.
Yeah.
But Derwin, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this evening. Derwin Hope there, speaking to me about his book, Charles Dickens, My Life, which is published by Little Brown. Oh, I beg your pardon. It's published by Clink Street.
Yeah. Now, Sean, if you want to see where it is, go onto the website, dickensmylife.com. That'll show you where it is.
All right, dickensmylife.com. Over the weekend, we heard the sad news of the death of Little Richard. Now, in this clip that we're about to hear, he answers the question, if he hadn't come along, would rock and roll have started sooner or later anyway?
I don't believe it would have got started at all. In my hometown, Macon, Georgia, where I'm from, I've never heard any rock and roll music before. It was Swing and Sway with Sammy Kay when I was a little boy.
Yeah, how old were you when you were listening to Sammy Kay?
I really didn't listen to him.
Uh-huh.
But I had gotten tired of hearing about him. And so what I did, I started playing the piano and I made up Tutti Frutti.
Mm-hmm.
And I sung Tutti Frutti for many years before I recorded it.
Yeah.
Because everybody thought it was crazy. You know, wah ba balloon ba ba bam boom.
Yeah.
Didn't nobody know what it meant, and I didn't either.
Yeah.
Wah ba balloon ba ba bam bam Tutti Frutti. Oh, rude. 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 Wah ba balloon ba ba bam bam. I got a girl named Sue.
On his death in 1989, the writer John Broderick bequeathed monies to the Arts Council with the intention that they would be used for, quote, the benefit and assistance and advancement of the arts in Athlone. One of the programmes, which was subsequently founded to fulfil this wish, was the John Broderick Writer in Residence in the Aidan Heavey Library in Athlone. Poet Martin Dyer is the current John Broderick Writer in Residence, and he joins me now on the line. Just remind us, first of all, if you would, Martin, about John Broderick and what he achieved as a writer.
I'm afraid I can't hear you terribly well there, Sean.
I was just saying, could you tell me a little bit about John Broderick and what he achieved as a writer?
Yes, I have you there now. Certainly, Sean, and great to be with you. John Broderick was an extraordinary writer, and we don't hear very much about him these days. And that's kind of an enigma. He published 12 novels. The first five or six were critically acclaimed. They sold in tens of thousands. He was a contentious figure along the way. He had been a critic through the 1950s, published hundreds of reviews through the 1950s in the Irish Times and the Independent before publishing his first novel, The Pilgrimage, in 1961, which many people think of as his best. The Pilgrimage is certainly one to recommend. And he remained a prolific. He remained a visible and a strident critic through his career. But he entered a kind of a self-created silence in the latter part of his life. And there's kind of a sense of exile in Bath. Mm-hmm. He ultimately leaves Ireland pursuing peace of some kind. But he continued to write. So he's not as prominent as he should be. But there are a great many people who love his work,
yeah.
And he's certainly somebody who we should be reading more.
And it's an extraordinary bequest that I think it's close on €400,000, if I have my figures correct, that he left for this idea, the benefit and assistance and advancement of the arts in Athlone. And this project that you're part of, the John Broderick Writer in Residence at the Aidan Heavey Library in Athlone. When did that actually start, Martin, and what have you been doing during your tenure as the Writer in Residence?
So I received the award last summer, Sean, and from September into this year, I've been in residence and going every week to the extraordinary Aidan Heavey Library in Athlone Town. It's been, for the most part, a teaching residency, so I've in part actually been exploring the work of John Broderick. But from a poetry perspective, he was an authority on poetry too, delivering courses and evenings around creative writing.
You've also, specifically, you've been mentoring a number of local writers. How difficult has that been in this period of confinement that we're all experiencing?
Well, we happily managed to cultivate the dialogue before coronavirus, and it was wonderful through that time. And part of that is due to the fact that there really is a vibrancy in terms of writing in Athlone and Westmeath. So it was really straightforward just to plug in and find that rapport, and not least because my predecessor, the poet Anne-Marie Nicaron, had built something really special. So there was a sense of the meaning of the residency itself, and there were a great many people who were attracted to it. But certainly we've transitioned now, and it's different to be corresponding. But maybe in a way it's a perfect tail end to my residency that now it's all about the words. And people like Jackie Gorman there in Athlone, distinguished writers, and it's tremendously vibrant.
Yeah, of course, as you say, then the coronavirus didn't really affect that so badly. But unfortunately, many of those who may have been studying one of your best known poems, Death and the Post Office, which is on the syllabus for this year's Leaving Certificate, I hope they won't just throw the poem to the one side now and forget about it. Do you have sympathy for their situation this year, Martin?
Oh, I certainly do, Sean. I mean, it's an enormously difficult position to be in. And I've been thinking in terms of how acute that uncertainty has been for those teenagers. And I think there's a particular political intensity to the calls to get it sorted for them. When I think about their exposure to poetry, I don't worry in the loss of the formal exam. And that's partly, I suppose, related to the fact that as a poet, my ultimate concern is for that encounter with the poem and how special it can be, and the reflective elements of the encounter with the poem, and ultimately what poetry does to us and how we carry it. And that is separate from exams, and that's separate from points and all of that. So I hope that some of the students will have had an opportunity to have felt stimulated by poetry and to have identified with it, and that they'll carry it forward. It's one of the things that I'd certainly recommend to secondary school students. The transition will remain uncertain. Obviously, there's a particular heat and ambivalence around how the grades are going to be awarded, that new kind of assessment. But there's something else to be carried forward. Right. Life will go on. So I'm wondering, are they going to be given an opportunity actually to reflect about what it has meant to be in secondary school, and particularly in the last year or two, to be thinking about carrying themselves forward as individuals, not only as people who are pursuing careers.
And perhaps to be able to read your poem without thinking about an exam, which I suppose is exactly the best way to look at the poem altogether.
Absolutely, that's the ideal. And I mean, so often, and many teachers will say this, so often the poem just really comes alive in the discussion.
All right.
We underestimate the students. They bring a great deal to the table.
Of course. Well, listen, thanks for speaking with us this evening, Martin. That's Martin Dyer. And I should tell you also that the John Broderick Writer in Residence Award that Martin is just finishing up on his tenure, the deadline for submissions for the next session of that has been extended to May the 15th. And you can find out full details on Westmeath Coco, as in County Council, westmeathcoco.ie/John Broderick Residency. Richard Ford is the much-loved author of novels such as The Sports Writer, Independence Day, Canada and Wildlife, which was filmed in 2018, starred Carey Mulligan and Jake Gyllenhaal, with direction by Paul Dano. Sorry for Your Trouble is a new short story collection, Ford's sixth, and it has more than a hint of Irish America about it. In fact, just over a year ago, we spoke to Richard Ford in the Hunt Museum as part of the Limerick Literary Festival. Of course, that was when you could actually attend festivals and sit down with an audience for a face-to-face interview. I remember Richard Ford as an entertaining and engaging conversationalist for sure. And indeed, I believe he referred to some of the stories in this new collection during that interview. Peter Murphy has been reading Sorry for Your Trouble for us, and he joins me now. American writers, definitely a strong tradition in the short story as well as the novel. Peter, where does Richard Ford's work sit in that context, do you think?
Somewhere halfway between, I'd say, the 1940s, 1950s, very southern tradition of Flannery O'Connor, Eudora Welty storytellers, and the more sort of 1960s cosmopolitan New York school of Roth, Bellow, Updike, all those guys. And it's generally a generation described as the dirty realists, who all came of age in the late 70s, mid 80s. A lot of them are the Iowa workshop scene of the early 80s.
So in this collection, I mean, in this collection, which is called Sorry for Your Trouble, that's a very Irish phrase. Is there an overarching Irish feel to the collection?
Well, it's kind of extraordinary, really, that nobody's used that phrase before now as the title of a book of fiction. There's a sliver of Irish Americana running through most of the stories. A couple of them are set in Ireland. There's one quite atypical story for Richard Ford in that it deals with a 30-something woman who's having an affair, who stays over in Dublin on a day shopping in the Maldron Hotel. And there's another one set on a ferry from Wales coming across Dublin, in which an American man getting divorced become swarmed by a group of American ladies who are going to attend a Lionel Richie concert. Those are the two explicitly Irish set stories, but most of the characters, most of the stories contain Irish American immigrants, or there are Irish people involved in it, or even spiritually, if they're not explicitly Irish, there's a sense of loss and regret and a sort of backward looking sorrow at the heart of them all, I would say.
Yeah, the story that you're speaking about, which refers to the crossing over the Irish Sea between Dublin and Wales, is called Crossing. I should explain, we have a slight delay on the line, so just bear with us on that. The other story that you mentioned in there about Irish immigrants, not specifically set in Ireland, but one which he spoke to me again about at that interview in Limerick, was Displaced. It's a very dark story. Set in an Irish immigrant community and involves a drive-in cinema. Do you remember, did that story strike you in any way, Peter?
He did, because it's somewhere between, I don't know, the ice storm, a very kind of 1970s type of coming-of-age story, and almost getting into sort of Stephen King, dark undercurrent of the drive-in scenario. It's basically a story about two boys, one of them who's kind of preteen and one of them who's a bit older. The younger boy has just lost his father, so this kind of roughneck Irish immigrant called Niall moves into the area. He comes from a slightly rough, dysfunctional family. But Niall is a sort of a bit of a subject of hero worship of the younger guy. He's very streetwise, he's very cool. But the younger boy's mother quite likes him. So Niall takes him to the drive-in one night just to sort of get him out of the house. And he makes a move on him. And in the final pages of the story, it becomes apparent that the family is something of a... There's a very dark undercurrent of alcoholism, incest and dysfunction going on. And it's one of those kind of last-minute epiphanies that completely switches around the whole context of the story, which is not something that Ford does a lot. Usually you put down his stories, and the two longer ones in this collection, they're immensely affecting. They're about 40 or 50 pages long. One of them's called A Second Language, and the other one's called The Run of Yourself, and they're both to do with older white males. One of them who's a widower, and the other's to do with the sudden dissolution of a marriage. And you kind of put them down and you know something's happened, but you can't quite put your finger on it. It's almost the opposite of Joyce's fabled epiphany, whereby, you know, you are changed and the characters are changed, but you don't exactly know why. And it has the bizarre effect of the story following you around for days afterwards while you're trying to figure out what on earth is so affecting about it, even though there's nothing apparent that has gone on. And in fact, that is kind of his magic trick.
The Run of Yourself, I suppose, in itself, almost a kind of an Irish phrase as well. But you brought up something interesting there, Peter, in that you said we're dealing with white males and quite often loss and reasonable privilege in most of the characters that Richard Ford presents to us. Does he break any new ground in this collection of short stories?
It's very much traditional Ford territory. I'd say two-thirds or three-quarters are like classic Fordian characters. And it must be said, I'd made attempts to read a couple of Ford's novels and never made it to the end of them. And I realize now that he's a short story master, and that's where I should have begun maybe 10 or 15 years ago. In fact, he's a brilliant short story editor as well. He's put together the Granta Book of the American Short Story. So most of it, and the characters could be kind of interchangeable. If there's one criticism to be made of this collection, and it's really down to your own taste as whether you consider it a fault line or not, is that it could be like an episodic novel, all dealing with the same kind of slightly adrift, slightly lost 50 to 60 something American male, most of the characters having suffered a loss of some sort. The other stories out are the ones that we've mentioned, one to do with Eileen, who the Irish, young Irish woman who takes a day out, in a free day, as it's called, in Dublin, displaced. And those are the ones that stick out just by dint of them being unusual territory for Ford. There's a bit of a misnomer, really, about the idea of what dirty realism is, which is very much in the same school as younger writers like T.C. Boyle or older ones like Tobias Wolff, which is dirty realism is not to do with, you know, machine workers or blue collar. It's more off-white collar. It's all divorced, upper middle class, reasonably well off, not starving, but kind of down at heel, shabby people coming apart at the seams at the beginning of the third act.
Important to say too that while I know you're saying there that the stories may be the route into the novel, we're talking about novels that have had serious success in terms of the sports writer and Independence Day and Wildlife. And I wonder, to some extent, I found this myself reading some of the stories as well. You really have to give yourself over to the stories. He has this ability to write a long, sinewy, winding sentence, and you must hand yourself over to that sentence to go with the story.
It's very interesting what he does with language, and I know that Ford is, from reading interviews with him, that he's kind of obsessed with language, which may seem like an obvious thing to say about a writer, but, you know, the construction of language, the power of words, linguistics, how they operate as symbols. But his style is very transparent. It's not flashy at all. It's very much about character and circumstance. But he's brilliant, as any short story writer must be. He's brilliant on the kind of the foibles and the little things that, and the telling detail and the unusual way that people relate. In The Run of Yourself, something very strange happens in the last scene of it, which is this widower goes for a drink in a bar, and a young woman in her late 20s confesses to him after a drink that she's sleeping in her car and can she stay over in his place. And he kind of reluctantly agrees, knowing it's a bad idea. And the surprise is that it doesn't end up in a seedy way. And it doesn't either produce a kind of obvious sense of regeneration in him. But you get this sense that there's been a tiny shift in this guy's psyche, but in the scope of how his life is, it's going to have a major effect on him. And he does that really well over and over in these stories.
A good reading for the situation we find ourselves in at the moment. I know a lot of people are talking about how difficult it is to concentrate in terms of reading as well as in terms of writing. But a short story doesn't demand as much in terms of that long journey. Perhaps it's a perfect accompaniment to lockdown, Peter.
I spent a glorious afternoon, which I haven't done in a long time, sitting in the sun like some old geezer in my favourite chair, making my way through this book, and without nodding off. It was actually quite riveting. But in a funny way, there's no accident. It took me back to a sort of golden period of reading I had in the early 2000s, where I read T.C. Boyle's After the Plague, Tobias Wolff's Our Story Begins, and Naimi Hempel's The Dog of the Marriage, and indeed Ford's own American Short Story, all amazing anthologies of short stories, all very much the quiet desperation of Americans. In, you know, Fitzgerald said, there are no second acts in American lives. This book gives lie to that notion. Everybody's in the second act here. They're all on their second marriage, their second mortgage, their second home. The children are grown up and they're all looking for a way to go around again and find some sense of life and hope and freshness in old rituals.
A recommendation then from you, Peter Murphy.
very much. I didn't even think about enjoying this. I just did. It was like going for a swim. I liked
Perfect.
It very much.
That's Peter Murphy speaking to us about Richard Ford's latest collection of short stories, which is called Sorry for Your Trouble. It's published by Bloomsbury. Behind the Music is a series of articles currently available on the website of the National Concert Hall. Therein you can read 10 facts about Handel's Messiah or 5 facts about Bach's St. John Passion, much more besides. Last time I visited the site, I was drawn to an article on music in a time of crisis. And that article was written by our regular Arena contributor, Roisin Dwyer. We asked her to share her thoughts on music in a time like this with us, and she joins me on the line this evening. I suppose we think we're unique in going through this worldwide pandemic, but this has happened before. It probably will happen again, Roisin. What do you think it is that music can do for us in a situation like we currently find ourselves in? Because that's at the heart of this article.
Yeah. Well, as you said, Sean, you know, there's evidence going back as far as 7 BC when the poet Thalatus was petitioned to sing hymns in Sparta when the plague struck. But you can break it down on a scientific level. We all know listening to music makes us feel better because it heightens positive emotions in the reward centres of the brain by releasing that elusive chemical dopamine. But also on a social level, in researching this article, I came across some research by a German psychologist, Stefan Kolsch, who looked into this area in Berlin in Freie University. And he sort of pinpointed several mechanisms that define why music helps us in these times. It helps us relate to each other by impacting brain circuits involved in empathy and trust and cooperation. So sort of on a personal and on a social level, it really is a great refuge for us in these times.
You also looked at past situations with parallels to our current situation, going back, first of all, to the 1400s and John Cook. What did he compose and what was he composing? Why was he composing that piece at the time?
Yes, John Cook, who was actually a member of Henry V's household, composed a hymn called Stella Caeli. This is one of the earliest evidence of sort of a crisis influencing the content of a piece of music. Stella Caeli was a plea for deliverance from illness. It was a hymn to the Virgin Mary. And it's sort of the first, that we can pinpoint evidence of reference. It actually makes direct reference to the Black Plague. And then a little later in 1723, Bach composed his cantata number 25 just after the Great Plague of Marseille. That was titled There Is Nothing Sound in My Body. And, you know, the lyrics, you, my doctor, Lord Jesus alone, know the best cure. So there's, you know, early evidence of pandemics and plague and crises influencing what people were composing and writing in those early years.
Yeah, and even a line within that Bach cantata, my plague cannot be healed by any herb or ointment, could have been written almost in the last, you know, couple of months.
Absolutely. Like looking back, over the centuries, it really is, it really is a timeless timeless theme. And then like looking into our own experience, of course, the Great Famine in Ireland, probably one of the best known visitors to the Isle in the mid 1800s, the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass, he sort of pinpointed, there's a great quote from his memoirs, I've never heard any songs like those anywhere since I left slavery, except when in Ireland. There I heard the same wailing notes and was much affected by them. It was during the famine of 1845. Nowhere outside of dear old Ireland in the days of want and famine have I heard sounds so mournful. So the people of Ireland were channeling their pain through the music and the songs they were singing.
Yeah, and of course the lament, such an important form in terms of Irish music. But moving ourselves into the 20th century and the scourge of two world wars, let's listen to a song which evokes the first of those wars, 1914 to 1918, The War to End All Wars.
Thank you.
Keep the home fires burning there from John McCormack and Roisin Dwyer speaking to us this evening about music in a time of crisis. Interesting that that's kind of at the beginning of World War One, Roisin, and it's you know, let's wait till the boys get home. Everything will be fine in a couple of months' time. Things changed as the war progressed in musical terms as well.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, even before that, you had music as a recruitment tool and songs like Your Country, Your King and Country Needs You. But it was very quickly replaced by those songs yearning for an end to hostilities. And like as well as the music people were listening to, you had people like soldiers. Actually, the English composer Ivor Gurney was a soldier in the First World War, and he spent 15 months at the front. And whilst there, even though he was shot and gassed, he composed five songs, one wonderful song by a beer side he wrote in a trench by candlelight. Like, what an amazing feat. And then in the classical realm, you have people like Ravel, who named each of the movements of his Le Tombeau de Couperin for friends who had lost their lives. So yeah, throughout the First World War, you have, you know, the songs that people sought refuge in, and also the activities of the war influence the music that was produced at that time. And of course, sing-alongs and music hall attendance and sheet music flourished. So, you know, people, the general population, were very drawn to music as a sort of solace.
Well, let's listen to a little section of that Ivor Gurney composition, By a Beer Side, lyrics by John Misfield, and the singer here is Sarah Connolly. And that's Sarah Connolly there with By a Beer Side, composed by Ivor Gurney, as Roisin Dwyer has been telling us, in the trenches of World War One, and the lyrics there, those of John Misfield. One of the constant comparisons that's been made between COVID-19 and other illnesses is the Spanish flu, which broke out just as the war ended in 1918. Are there musical references to that anywhere, Roisin?
Yeah, actually, that was when I was doing my research. And of course, as you said, lots of comparisons have been drawn between COVID. I couldn't find many references. But then when I did find them, it was all within one genre, and one very appropriate genre, the blues. So you've songs like Blind Willie Johnson's Jesus Is Coming Soon. And I found a great recording of S.E. Jenkins, the 1919 Influenza Blues. And I have to say, the lyrics and the way she sings it really evoke, you know, the sadness and the pain, which we can, as you said, relate to so vividly today, going through this COVID crisis.
Well, let's hear S.E. Jenkins and the 1919 Influenza Blues.
We messed up with the doctors, call the flu. People die everywhere. Death went creeping through the air, and the groans of the rich sure were sad.
They are extraordinary lyrics, really, aren't they? The 1919 Influenza Blues. S.E. Jenkins, the singer, and presumably playing the piano there as well. Roisin Dwyer is speaking to us this evening about an article she has written on the National Concert Hall's website, Music in a Time of Crisis. As we move a little bit further into the 20th century then, and I suppose in and around the Second World War, Shostakovich and classical music come into their own in this particular situation, Roisin.
Yeah, absolutely. Shostakovich composes his Leningrad Symphony No. 7, inspired by Hitler's attack on Russia in 1941. And it was actually dedicated to the city of Leningrad. And remarkably, the premiere took place while the city was still under siege by Nazi forces. But a wonderful example of patriotic art in a time when morale really needs to be boosted.
We listen to a section of the Allegretto movement from Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony. ¶¶ section there from the Allegretto movement from the Symphony No. 7 in C major of Dmitri Shostakovich, the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. By the time we got to the end of World War II, you talked about sheet music and World War I, Roisin Dwar, but radio really came into its own post and during World War II.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have people like Vera Lynn, who actually celebrated her 103rd birthday recently, belovedly known as the Forces Sweetheart. And, you know, a song synonymous with the Second World War, there'll be Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover and We'll Meet Again, which the Queen actually referenced in her speech last month also. And then you have musicians, you know, themselves volunteering for work during wartime, like Marlene Dietrich. Of course, her Lily Marlene was hugely popular at the time, and she performed for the forces in a wide variety of places like Algeria and Italy and the United Kingdom. Billy Wilder actually joked that she spent more time at the front line than Eisenhower. And Glenn Miller himself, of course, was a little too old for active duty, but he signed up to boost morale by modernising the army band. And of course, in 1944, tragically, his plane disappeared on the way to entertain troops in France. The US War Department even took it upon themselves to send V-discs, victory discs, which were popular artists of the time singing songs to cheer up the troops. And very often these would have little introductions. For example, on one, the Andrews sisters are heard to say, "We're making these V-discs just for you. And along with them, we want to send you all our love and kisses." So it was really was recognised, just the power of music to boost morale and to help troops through this terrible time.
All right, well, let's finish up with a little clip of the Andrews sisters then and their Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy.
He makes a company jump when he plays reveille. He's the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B.
He was a Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B. And when he plays Boogie Woogie Bugle, he was busy as a bzzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump A to the bar. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B.
Ah, yes, the wonder of the Andrews sisters and their wonderful harmonies. Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. And before that, it was Roisin Dwar who was speaking to us about music in a time of crisis. You can read Roisin's article on the National Concert website, nch.ie. And while there are no events happening at the moment, obviously in the National Concert Hall, there's lots going on the website, so worth checking it out. That's our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.